Tonight is an odd talk, since Independence Day is coming this coming weekend. I was going to talk about the spiritual foundations of the United States. It's funny, sometimes the rhetoric on the Christian right is that the United States is a Christian nation. It was founded to be a Christian nation, and that is... That's just entirely non-factual. The founding folks were really concerned very much with keeping separation between church and state. Religious freedom was very much part of their plan. And so what were their ideals? And I'll just say briefly that, of course, they were Englishmen, and at that time, England, the church was under the control of the king. The king of England was the head of the Anglican church, and it was a very tightly controlled society that way. You had to swear allegiance to the church in order to hold any office, and if you didn't swear this allegiance, then you couldn't hold any political office. And so it was a, you know, in any spiritual work you were doing on your own, you kind of had to keep secret, basically. And so they were very excited to found a nation where that was not going to be the case, where there was this freedom to pursue whatever spiritual work worked for you. We have this amazing phrase in the Declaration of Independence about the inalienable rights, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And between the 18th century and now, this word happiness and the word happy, it has really lost a lot of its value. You know, in modern speak, happy is it's a mood, it's a temporary feeling. You know, something I liked happened, that makes me happy. Something I didn't like happened, that makes me unhappy. You know, it's something seen to fluctuate with the trivial ups and downs of everyday life. For Jefferson, happiness was closer to what Aristotle meant by eudaimonia, the whole life satisfaction that comes from living out one's authenticity. You know, so, sort of knowing that I'm living the life that I was meant to live. And so really that phrase, pursuit of happiness, that was his way of talking about freedom of religion. And similarly, liberty or freedom, I think is also a word that has lost a certain amount of its value. I think if you ask people on the street today, what is freedom? I think the intuitive answer you'd get from so many people is, I can do whatever I want. And that's a very poor definition of freedom. That's it's a problematic definition of freedom. As we know very clearly from Buddhism, when I'm running willy-nilly after what I want, I'm not free. You know, I'm enchained in a kind of addiction. And, you know, it's the nature of all addictions that addictions contain the illusion of freedom in them. You know, the person says, I can quit any time, and they don't realize they have a problem. So doing what I want, that's not necessarily a path toward freedom or even a path toward happiness. Freedom is much more like inner spaciousness, the ability to rest in a place of equanimity and be at a kind of inner balance where one is not constrained by desire or fear. And from this place of deep intentionality, being able to choose that which moves me toward greater authenticity, you know. So, you know, this ability to make a very intentional choice. And really, I think there was an idealism among the folks who founded this country that if they separated church from state and they really gave people this kind of freedom, then everyone would go off and they'd all do their personal growth work and everyone would be enlightened and fulfilled and living their authentic lives. And of course, we know that that is so much not the case in the way that things play out. They really thought that they were founding a novus ordo seclorum, a new order of the ages. That's a phrase we'll see in a minute on the Great Seal. And in a more narrow sense, I will give credit where credit is due. They set up a government that was based on democracy and started a trend. And really, it's rather incredible that in 200 years, democracy has become kind of a standard. I mean, even in dictatorships, they have to run mock elections to kind of pay tribute to democracy because democracy is kind of a standard. I give them credit for that. But unfortunately, there's a lot about human nature, I guess, they weren't appreciating, and that when you give people freedom, the last thing that they do is move toward their own happiness and fulfillment. It's actually a sad thing about human life that most people are not equipped to make themselves happy. And so we live in a nation that in many ways falls kind of short of at least what some of the founding folks had in mind. And so it's an interesting question. It's an interesting way to look at your life. If the folks who founded this country got in a time machine and they zipped forward and they looked at your life in particular as the example of someone living in America, would they be pleased at what they saw? It's not to beat yourself up. It's more just to acknowledge, all of us live in a web of responsibility. We've gained so much from parents, from teachers, from, guides of all sorts. How do we bear those gifts? We've also gained something from the people who set up this country. How do we bear what we've received from them? So just another interesting way to look at your life. I want to talk a little about a very famous image, an image that I think will be familiar to all of you, image of the Great Seal of the United States. And so this visual is one side of it, and then this is the other side of it. I think the eagle side is technically the front and the pyramid side is the back. But I'll talk about the pyramid side first. This appears, of course, on the $1 bill. It appears on passports. And so what's going on here? You might say that the more exoteric meaning is what it's saying about the United States as a whole, what it's saying about the macrocosm and the ideals that it's kind of ascribing to the macrocosm. But I would point out that the United States is not going, as a country, is not going to live up to ideals unless we individual Americans are living up to those ideals, So in many ways, it is, it can be read more as a set of symbols about individual ideals, ideals that we should be living in our own lives. And so first, the pyramid. Below the pyramid, again, this phrase that I mentioned earlier, novus ordo seclorum, a new order of the ages. And above the pyramid, Anuit Cheptis has favored our undertaking or has favored all this activity. In Latin, the pronoun is left unclear. It could be he, she, or it has favored our undertaking. And usually that's taken to be the divinity, the sacred, has favored our undertaking, the divinity represented by the eye above the pyramid, which is you know, has some origin in the Eye of Horus in Greek mythology, but actually was a powerful Christian symbol throughout the Middle Ages, the eye in a triangle like that. And so what does this symbol say to us, this unfinished pyramid? And I think I would say at a very basic level, it's saying that we're imperfect, and that's okay. It's saying that to be human is to be imperfect, incomplete, a work in progress. And where we find completion is in the sacred. In other words, we find completion not in an ego kind of attaining, but rather in a letting go, a surrender, an offering, an allowing something greater to move through us. I think there's, in the secular society, there's very much a story that, you know, there should be a moment when I can get to the pinnacle. You know, I, ego, can get to this pinnacle and say, look at me. I have everything handled. I'm at my peak now. And that doesn't happen. You know, it's and there's something very comforting in the story that, you know, not only we're imperfect, we're designed to be imperfect. We're designed to be incomplete, so that we can be completed by surrender to the sacred. There's this wonderful phrase from the writing of St. Augustine, our hearts are restless until they rest in thee. This idea that that we don't find that deeper fulfillment or that completion until we open to the sacred in some way. And, you know, whether we call that Buddha nature or the Holy Spirit, you know, that sort of thing. Now, the other side, there's a lot going on this other side. First of all, it's an eagle. And an eagle, like any bird of prey, is, what is astounding about any bird of prey is its vision. And so one of the central things about this is just about the importance of vision and having a vision and seeing clearly. That I would say is a driving symbol here. There's what the eagle holds in its hands, arrows and an olive branch. At the more macrocosm scale, this represents powers of war and powers of peace. At a personal level, among other things, it represents good boundaries. It represents having an authentic no and an authentic yes. You know, not the wishy-washy, you know, yes, that really means no, but I'll say yes to be polite kind of thing, you know, being very clear about our boundaries. And another level, I'd say that arrows are in many ways an ancient symbol of intention or intentionality, ability to hit a target from afar, and the focus and the aim it takes to hit a target. And you might say that it also represents a kind of balance of deep intention and deep surrender, both of which are very important for spiritual work. The shield that the eagle has, or the badge that the eagle is wearing, red, white, and blue, it's very much recognizable as a symbol of the United States. And what I take from that is it's sort of moving forward with this badge of here I am. You know, and to what extent do we walk into the world with the powerful statement, here's who I am, here's who I am in my authenticity? You know, do we show up powerfully in the world as we are, or do we, you know, as opposed to being polite and hiding who we really are and, you know, showing up as we think people think we should show up, you know, that sort of thing. The message I take here is really about putting yourself out there and showing up powerfully. Then there's the curious symbol of stars above the eagle, 13 stars. And 13 is a big number here, because there's also 13 arrows, there are 13 leaves and 13 olives on the olive branch. And it's fascinating because, how can I say, there easily could have been 15 or 16 colonies. Like, you know, soon after the Constitution was ratified, a few more states joined very quickly. And so there could have been more, but they intentionally wanted 13 because of the numerological powers of 13. And you know, part of that is there were 13 people attending the Last Supper, but also part of the magic of 13 was this particular diagram. This particular diagram, which is the Seal of Solomon, which consists of a triangle going up and a triangle going down. I don't know if you can see, like, an equilateral triangle of 10 and then another triangle 10 pointing upward. And there are many, many esoteric symbols of this. You might say that it represents a union of above and below, and even a kind of redemption of what is below by bringing it in contact with what is above.
I don't see that triangle.
So,
in the star?
So, like these a, 10.
Oh, okay, I see it now.
Yeah, and then like these.
Pointed star, yeah.
Yeah, so 10 making a triangle this way, and then 10 making a triangle that way. So in many ways, this star is, it has a similar message to the ancient alchemical symbol of the Philosopher's Stone, the union of highest and lowest. And then finally, there's the motto that the eagle has, E Pluribus Unum, and of course this appears on all our coins also. From many one. And there are a number of meanings here. First of all, I would say a kind of, I would call it a love that crosses all boundaries of otherness. One of the things that most impresses me whenever I read the Christian Gospels is that there's such a powerful message, both in Jesus' words and in Jesus' consistent actions, in talking about and living out this love across all boundaries of otherness, this inclusive love that refuses to recognize any other, you know, and from the various ways that we other people in the world, from that many making one. And I'd say that's one of the meanings. And that quality of love across otherness, we can cultivate toward external others. We can also cultivate that within.
Wouldn't, Mike, is it okay to ask questions?
Sure.
Wouldn't, like, more, like Occam's razor, the more natural explanation would be that for many colonies there's just one.
Oh, that's certainly the literal meaning, yes. There are many mystical meanings to this. Yes, the very literal meaning is from many colonies, one, from many people from many places, one people, you know, those are the more exoteric meanings. I'd say it's a more esoteric meaning, the love across boundaries of otherness. So first of all, in the interpersonal world, but also in the intrapersonal world, all the ways that we other internally, the places that we refuse to feel, the places we say, oh, that's not me, you know, all the places that we other, healing is about initiating a love across boundaries of inner otherness. And finally, I'd say the most mystical meaning of E Pluribus Unum points to non-dualism, the non-dual experience that is that you might say is the goal of all spirituality. I must say it amuses me a little bit. I don't know what the Christian right would think if they found out that this Latin motto on their money actually was entirely consistent with a Advaita Vedanta Hinduism, you know. But there it is. So I'll share a quote sheet. and on the topic of vision, where there's no vision, people perish. All these incredibly powerful gems hidden in the book of Proverbs. From the Gnostic Gospel of Thomas. So this
What is that?
So the Gnostic Gospel, there are four canonical Gospels in the official Bible. This was something discovered in the 20th century. It was an early writings from the first or second century that were buried in a clay pot, and they were rediscovered in the 20th century, the Gnostic school. The Gospel of Thomas is just a collection of sayings of Jesus, some of which are identical to what we find in the regular Gospels, but some of them are more, they have a more Zen quality. So, for example, this one, Jesus said, if you bring forth what is within you, what you have will save you. The one that I quoted earlier from St. Augustine, you have made us for yourself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless till they rest in you. The idea that the top of the pyramid does not belong to us. From George Eliot, but what we call our despair is often the painful eagerness of unfed hope. And I think that speaks to a lot of what we see in modern America. Henri Emile says, learn to be what you are and learn to resign yourself with good grace all that you are not. Robert Louis Stevenson said, to be what we are and to become what we are capable of becoming is the only end of life. Gandhi said, whenever you are confronted with an opponent, conquer him with love, which is a beautiful expression of the attitude of love across boundaries of otherness. Carl Jung said, one does not become enlightened by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious. The latter procedure, however, is disagreeable and therefore not popular. This speaks very much to the logic of the Star of Solomon. He also said, the experience of the self is always a defeat for the ego. Again, talking about, you know, the surrender needed to get to the top of the pyramid. Nisargadatta Maharaj said, all separation, every kind of estrangement and alienation is false. All is one. Anais Nin said simply, life expands or shrinks according to one's courage. George Leonard said, intentionality fuels the master's journey. And every master is a master of vision. Zig Ziglar said, what you get by achieving your goals is not as important as what you become by achieving your goals. Ken Wilber said, boundary lines of any type are never found in the real world itself, but only in the imagination of map makers. Sharon Salzberg in O Magazine said, if we fail, we don't need self-recrimination or blame or anger. We need a reawakening of our intention and a willingness to recommit to be wholehearted once again. Steve Jobs said, your time is limited, so don't waste it on living somebody else's life. Don't be trapped by dogma, which is living with the results of other people's thinking. Don't let the noise of others' arguments drown out your inner voice, and most important, have the courage to follow your heart and intuition. They somehow already know what you truly want to become. Everything else is secondary. Henry Cloud said, boundaries define us. They define what is me and what is not me. A boundary shows me where I end and someone else begins, leading me to a sense of ownership. Knowing what I am to own and take responsibility for gives me freedom. Taking responsibility for my life opens up many different options. Brené Brown said, authenticity is the daily practice of letting go who we think we're supposed to be and embracing who we are. Race Mamenikin says, our virtues are wrapped inside of our limitations. It's only when we are in close proximity to others that we begin to intimately explore the boundaries of our virtues by slamming into our limitations. Love that one. Mark and Angel Chernoff said, our character is often revealed at highs and lows, Be humble at the mountaintops. Be steadfast in the valleys. Be faithful in between. Tremendous amount of wisdom in that. Sheila Bethel says, one of the most courageous things you can do is identify yourself, know who you are, know what you believe in, and where you want to go. Rashid Ungularu said, the energy we show up with is more often than not the energy we encounter. There's a deep truth there. You know, the way I show up in the world, it really is reflected back to me in the experience I had. Anton St. Martin said, like a Columbus of the heart, mind, and soul, I've hurled myself off the shores of my own fears and limiting beliefs to venture out into the uncharted territories of my inner truth in search of what it means to be genuine and at peace with who I really am. I've abandoned the masquerade of living up to the expectation of others and explored new horizons of what it means to be truly and completely me in my amazing imperfection and most splendid insecurity. Benjamin Kofu Kwanash said, a life well spent is a life driven by purpose. Shannon Alder says, staying silent is like a slowly growing cancer to the soul and a trait of a true coward. There's nothing intelligent about not standing up for yourself. You may not win every battle. However, everyone will at least know what you stood for. You. And finally, Alaric Hutchinson says, bravery is the choice to show up and listen to another person, be it a loved one or a perceived foe, even when it is uncomfortable, painful, or the last thing you want to do.